Okay, I have one thing left over from last week's lecture, and that was I wanted to talk about, Euler products for the L function of a modular form. So this was determining when an L function of a modular form had an Euler product was one of the sort of crowning achievements of Hecke, and he did this by introducing what are now called Hecke operators. And there's one, let's see if I can keep my notation straight. One for each integer. Okay? And these are going to act on modular forms. And to describe their action, what they basically are, I mean, they're basically averaging operators. This sort of averages over the action of integral matrices of determinant M on modular forms. And to be able to describe that, let me introduce sort of a weight K action of GL2 plus R on holomorphic functions on the upper half plane. And what this action is going to be, so if I take just the usual matrix and GL2 plus R and holomorphic function on the upper half plane, so it's a weight K action, so it's usually denoted F slash KG of Z, and this is the one that everyone was clamoring for last week, is determinant G to the K over 2 divided by CZ plus D to the K F of GZ, where this is the linear fractional action. And in this notation, modularity of weight K for discrete group gamma becomes just that F slash K gamma is equal to F for all gamma and gamma. Okay? So that's the action. Now, so I now want to average over integral matrices of determinant M. So let me let LM be exactly that set. These are just integral matrices, so M to Z, and they'll have determinant M. Let me let delta M be a particular subset of these. These are going to be the upper triangular matrices. So they have determinant M. I put a 0 here, and then I'm going to reduce B mod D. And the importance of these is that these are actually coset representatives for matrices of determinant M modulo matrices of determinant 1. Okay. All right. Then I'm going to define... I should point out, to keep my life simple, I'm only going to talk about Hecke operators for SL2Z. I'm not going to worry about level. So to define, say, the nth Hecke operator on modular forms of weight K for SL2Z, as I said, it's an averaging operator. So let's see, TMF of Z is going to be, now there's a normalization factor, M to the K over 2 minus 1, and then I'm already invariant under SL2Z, so in some sense to average over LM, I just have to average over this set delta. So delta, and then F slash K delta. And if you write out what this is just in terms of the matrices, this is m to the k minus 1 sum delta. Here, I guess I get d to the minus k f of az plus b over d. Does that look right? It agrees with what I have written down. Okay, so we believe that. Now, from this expression, you can determine the action in terms of the Fourier expansion. So let me just write that down. What happens if you compute that? All I'm going to do is take the Fourier expansion of F . This is a modular form for SL2Z. And then I'm going to write TMF as the sum n equals 0 to infinity bn e to the 2 pi inz. Now you can actually check from that definition that this is again a form of weight k. And then you can work out expressions for the Fourier coefficients in terms of the Fourier coefficients of F. And let me get this right. It is the sum. The sum D divides the greatest common divisor of N and M. M coming from the Heck operator and N the Fourier coefficient you're looking at. D to the k minus 1, a to the nm over d squared. Okay, and that's just from tell me that this is correct. Yes. Okay. That comes from taking this linear fractional action, just plugging it into the Fourier expansion, and then doing the little sums. Yeah. No, I'm not doing anything hard. Okay. Yeah. No. And in particular, if you look at then what the constant coefficient is, B0 turns out to be, well, when I take n is equal to 0, I'm just summing over divisors of m, and here I'm going to get A0, and this is just the sum of the divisors of m to the k minus 1 power. A0. And if you figure out what the first Fourier coefficient is, well, now n is, this greatest common divisor is 1, and so all I'm getting is d has to be 1, n is 1, so I'm getting am. You can almost see that. Okay, so let me write down the basic properties of these. And you can either get them from dealing with the Heck operators this way, in terms of these integral matrices, or from the action on Fourier coefficients. The first thing is that so it maps modular forms to modular forms. Oops. And from this computation, you see that it preserves cusp forms, right? Because if you start with a cusp form, A0 is 0, then B0 is 0. So it preserves the space of cusp forms. Secondly, you can figure out what the product of two things is, and you can either do it from the double, from the cosets, or from here, and it's the sum d divides nm, sort of the same formula, d to the k minus 1 t nm over d squared. And from here you can see that these operators commute, because this expression is symmetric in n and m. And in particular, you can see that if these things are relatively prime, then the only divisor of the greatest common divisor is 1, so d is equal to 1, and you get that t n t m is t n times m. So the product is quite simple. And finally, if p is a prime, and you compute what tp times tp to the r is, the greatest common divisor here, I guess, is just p, so you get a term from d equals 1 and d equals p. When d is equal to 1, you get tp to the r plus 1. And when d is equal to p, you get p to the k minus 1 t. So I guess this is r p to the r plus 1 divided by p squared, so p to the r minus 1. So those are the basic properties of the Heck operators. Okay. Now, what Heck had discovered is that that the condition for the L function of a modular form to have an Euler product is simply that the modular form be an eigenfunction for all of these operators. So let's let, I'm going to call it HF. The F, that'll be related to something we do later. This is just going to be the Z algebra generated by all of the Hecke operators. That's the integral, called the integral Hecke algebra. So now let's suppose, that F is not that F. That's an F for finite. So. I either get in trouble now or I get in trouble later. I think I'll get in trouble. I'm going to leave that there, but that stands for finite. That's not the modular form F. Okay. So now let's suppose I have a cusp form. Whoops, I want a cusp form for SL2Z. And suppose that f of z is a simultaneous eigenfunction for all of the Heck operators. Okay. Oh, I should point out, let me back up and point out one thing here. I've said it's the Z algebra generated by all of the TMs, but if you think about these two formulas, then really what these boil down to is the fact that you can actually generate it by the TPs. It's generated by the TPs. So actually, okay. So suppose you have a simultaneous eigenfunction. What does that mean? So then, so I'm just going to write Tm of f to be lambda m of f, okay, for all m. Okay. Well, the first thing you do is you come over here. Did I say this was a CUS form? Yes, it's a CUS form. And you read off what the M4A coefficient is. Okay? Well, the M4A coefficient, the first Fourier coefficient. The first Fourier, you read off what the first Fourier coefficient is of F. Okay? Well, this thing says the first Fourier coefficient is lambda M1 times the first Fourier coefficient of F. On the other hand, this thing says the first Fourier coefficient of Tm applied to F is the mth Fourier coefficient of F. So you get this formula. And in particular, this says if the first Fourier coefficient is 0, all Fourier coefficients are 0. Okay? So you can normalize this such that A1 is equal to 1. Okay? If F is not 0. Okay? So I do this, and then this equality becomes that the Hecke eigenvalue, the mth Hecke eigenvalue is exactly the mth Fourier coefficient. Okay? Now, I want to make one point here, and this is, remember, from our examples, the Fourier coefficients carried arithmetic. Okay? For other situations, for GLN, for example, higher rank groups, you may have a complicated Fourier expansion, you may not have a Fourier expansion, but you will always have Hecke operators of some sort, you'll have Hecke eigenvalues, and those are the things that, in the general theory, you're going to carry the arithmetic. Okay? So the arithmetic is sort of being transferred from the Fourier coefficients themselves, where you saw it classically, to these eigenvalues of the Hecke operators. Okay. Okay. But now the L function, well, the L function now you can think of as either being in terms of the AMs or the Hecke eigenvalues. Let me go ahead and deal with it in terms of the AMs. But the thing is, these properties of the Hecke operators, right, will translate into properties of the eigenvalues, if you have a simultaneous eigenfunction, and then translate into properties of the Fourier coefficients. Okay, so the properties of the TM translate into, well, there's two of them in particular, so I'm going to label them 3 prime just to match with that. If N and M are relatively prime, then AN, AM is ANM. So the Fourier coefficients are multiplicative if the indices are relatively prime. And if P is a prime, then what this 4 translates into is AP. AP to the R is equal to AP to the R plus 1 plus P to the K minus 1 AP to the R minus 1, or 0, if you write it as a recursion, is equal to AP R plus 1 minus AP AP to the R plus P to the K minus 1 AP to the R minus 1. Okay? For the prime power Fourier coefficient. Okay. And so now we can go back and look at the L function. Okay, so what was this? Well, it was, in terms of the Fourier coefficients, it was a sum n equals 1 to infinity an over n to the s, where the an are the Fourier coefficients, And now the first thing you do is you use the fact that for relatively prime indices, the Fourier coefficients are multiplicative. And that lets you then factor this into a product over primes of the sums relating to the primes. So sum r equals 0 to infinity a p to the r over p to the rs. And then, then you want to sum this series in finite form. And that's exactly what this recursion relation lets you do. This recursion relation lets you sum this series, and you get the product over p of 1 minus ap, p to the minus s, plus p to the k minus 1, p to the minus 2 s inverse. And that's the Euler product expansion. Yes? Yes. Yes. Because and if you start with the assumption that this has an Euler product and you read back what it says, it gives you exactly those conditions on the Fourier coefficients. And then you can actually, in fact, trace it back even further. And in fact, the theorem that one has, is the following. So, theorem. So let's let F be a cusp form of weight K for SL2Z. Then F is a Hecke eigenform. Whoops, how do you spell Hecke? There. With first coefficient equals 1 is equivalent to the L function having an Euler product expansion of the appropriate form. 1 minus AP, P to the minus S, plus P to the K minus 1, P to the minus 2S inverse. Okay? So we did this direction, and in that direction is the answer to your question. Okay. So that's why L functions have Euler products. They have to be eigenfunctions of all the Hecke operators. And just to make something that I want to make connections with later on, we can also write this in terms of the completed L function, where we put on the completed L function had a factor of 2 pi to the minus s gamma of s, and then the usual Euler product. And I write it up here like this because when we start doing L functions of automorphic representations, we're going to treat all places equally, and that includes the infinite prime, and so there should be an Euler factor corresponding to the infinite prime, and that's what this is. And that P is up here. Okay. So you should think of each one of these as being an Euler factor for each finite prime. And this is one of these for the infinite prime. That's the way you should think of that, that we'll eventually think of that factor. I can point that out, yes. If you have higher level, this theorem is a little bit more complicated. In the following sense, first off, you actually have some problems if you want to treat gamma naught of n. Basically, what I've done up here works as long as you stay away from the level for primes that don't divide the level. If you have primes that divide the level, the theory of Hecke operators is more complicated at those primes, and the Euler factor that you get here is going to be different. Okay? It's going to be smaller. So, for almost all primes away from the level, it basically looks exactly like this. But at that finite number of primes, it's more complicated. So. Nope. I am not going to explain new forms and old forms. Because what I'm trying to do is get to automorphic representations of GLN. So no, I'm not going to do level, and I'm not going to do new forms and O forms. And this is all I planned on doing, because at some point I will want to do the unramified calculation, which is related to this calculation. So I wanted to see this calculation. No, this is not a complete course in the theory of modular forms. This is a review of things that will help one follow the rest of. No, I will do all places. Whether I actually do the explicit calculation at the ramified places, maybe not. But I will give a definition of the L function at all places. So there's only so much you can do in however many weeks I have. Okay. So I'm now going to start the second lecture, which is, and I will start it while I'm erasing. What I want to do now is I want to make the transition from the theory of classical modular forms, which is what I've done for the last couple of hours now. I want to begin to make the transition from that to the theory of automorphic forms, and then the theory of automorphic representations, because that's where the results that I want to spend most of my time on lie. They're in the theory of automorphic representations for GLN. Now, in doing this, there's going to be a change of tools as well. We're no longer, our main tool here was one complex variable when we analyze classical modular forms. Now the tool is going to become non-abelian harmonic analysis or representation theory. So what this lecture and the next one they will serve the purpose of, if you know automorphic representations, they should be a review. If you don't, they should be an introduction. Okay? Now, what that means is that I'm going to try to give, I mean, I'll show you how to translate from classical into adelic automorphic forms. I'll try to give precise definitions. I'll try to give precise statements. I'll try to prove nothing. Okay? So, if you haven't seen this before, then this is, you should just enjoy the statements and not worry about the technical parts. And if you've seen it before, then you can fill in the technical parts. Okay. So, automorphic forms. And so I'm going to begin just with automorphic forms. On GL2. Okay, so the first change is I'm going to take a modular form of weight m. My weight is now going to be m because I'm going to need k for something else. And I'm still going to concentrate on SL2z. This is just to give the ideas of the passage. Okay? Now this is a function on the upper half plane, and as we've said, the upper half plane is a symmetric space for GL2 plus R. So 2x2 matrices, real coefficients, positive determinant by linear fractional transformations. Okay? What's happened? Oh, I've got everything down already. So if we take the point I in the upper half plane as a base point, then the upper half plane is GL2 plus R. Basically, it's the orbit of I under linear fractional transformations, right? These things act transitively. And now the stabilizer of I has two things in it. It's got the center, and it's got what I'm going to call K infinity plus. That's to match up with a little bit later, where Z is, if you like, it's the set of diagonal matrices. So this is the center of GL2 plus. And K infinity plus is just SO2. So it's the maximal compact subgroup. Okay? So one thing, the first thing one does in going from classical modular forms on the upper half plane to automorphic forms on the group is one lifts this function to a function on the group. So we can lift f of z to f of g by, well, here I have GL2 plus R. I can map it down to the upper half plane through this action. I have little f here, and here is capital F. And so the definition is simply that F capital F of G is little f evaluated at the action of G on I. Okay? Now, as a function on GL2 plus R, it satisfies, well, it has some nice invariance properties, right? It satisfies f of zkg is equal to f of g, and this again is for z in the center, right? Because that stabilizes, it's in the center, so I can move it past g and it stabilizes I. And K in SO2. Okay. And it still has a modular transformation property under gamma, which was SL2Z, but it's also, if you think about it, it's also GL2 plus of Z, right? Because GL2Z is still integral matrices. They have to have integrally invertible determinant, which means the determinant has to be plus or minus 1 anyway. And so if I require it to be positive, then it's just SL2Z. Okay. All right. Now, in the modern theory of automorphic forms, one, instead of having a transformation law under your discrete group, one prefers to actually have invariance under gamma. Okay, so we desire gamma invariance. Okay? And so to this end, let us set this is called a canonical automorphy factor, J of GZ to be the determinant of G. Oh, I have to get all my, make sure I get my powers and everything correct, to the minus 1 half CZ plus D, where here G is A, B, C, D. And this can be O in GL2 plus R. And Z, of course, is in the upper half plane. Okay. Then in terms of J, modularity becomes, well, that F of gamma z is j of gamma z to the k F of z for gamma and gamma. Okay? Right, because if I'm on SL, this isn't there, and this is just CZ plus D to the K. So that's the old definition of modularity. But the point is that this makes sense for not only for gamma, it makes sense for anything in GL2 plus R. So to obtain gamma invariance, oops, I did it. Is this the first place that I've done it? Yes. My weight is mk. Here's why I had to change my weight, because of k. K is in the subgroup k. Okay. So to obtain gamma invariance, we just multiply by the inverse. We get rid of that factor. We consider, I'm going to call it now phi of g, and I'm going to take j of g I to the minus m f of g, which is the same thing as j of g I to the minus m little f of g times I. Okay? Okay. And now one checks, and this is not hard, that phi satisfies the following conditions. You have to do a little bit of check, but it's not hard to check that we have made this now invariant. Okay? It sort of makes sense because modularity gave me this transformation law, and I've just multiplied by the inverse of the transformation law. But there's a little bit to check here, but not much. I didn't do anything with z. If you work out what all this stuff is for the center, you still get that phi of zg is phi of g for z in the center. That didn't change. But if you work out what happens for the compact subgroup, one finds that now you have a transformation law under the compact subgroup. And this is for k theta, which is the usual cosine theta, sine theta, minus sine theta, cosine theta in the compact. So I've managed to make it gamma invariant. So I've swapped over here. My function capital F was invariant under k, but it inherited a transformation law under gamma. And by making it gamma invariant by doing this, I've introduced something under the compact. Okay? So I'll let you do the little calculation for that from here. But that's one thing I've done. I've traded. I've traded off modularity and k invariance for gamma invariance, but in some sense a modularity or a transformation law under the compact. Okay, and that's the price I have to pay if I want gamma invariance. Okay, so if you like, Fields Institute needs to get their counterweights fixed here. I think it stopped. So now, phi actually then is a function on GL2 plus R modulo gamma in the center. Okay, so that's what the transformation laws look like. I also had, for my classical modular form, I had two other conditions on it. I had a regularity condition, it was holomorphic, and I had a growth condition that, and there it was defined in terms of the Fourier expansion. Now I've left one complex variable, I'm up here with a function on this space of 2 by 2 real matrices, and so those conditions, the holomorphy and the holomorphy at the cusps, I can't talk about those in terms of holomorphy anymore. Okay? And it turns out what those translate into are something like the following. Regularity, that was holomorphy, that is F satisfies Cauchy-Riemann conditions, or F is killed by Del Barr, however you want to talk about that, but you can talk about that regularity in terms of differential equations somehow. Okay? When you work on a group, the way that you think about differential equations is the following. So I'm going to let G be the complexified Lie algebra of GL2 plus R. Okay? And actually here, that's really just 2x2 complex matrices. That's all that is. Then this has something called its universal enveloping algebra. Okay. And this contains its center. Okay. And now the point here is this, is that these are the bi-invariant differential operators on this group. Okay. And so in some sense, that's all you need to know about them. You don't really need to know that much about them. Just that they are, it's a nice algebra of bi-invariant operators. Okay? And the Cauchy-Riemann operator, or the Del Barr, whatever it is, that defines holomorphy sits in here somewhere. Okay? And so the condition of regularity can now be written as turns out if you do the analysis in the, where am I at, 4 now? In this language, and you analyze what this thing is, it just turns out the holomorphy becomes that this function is an eigenfunction for this algebra. That's what happens. Right and left translation. Yeah, it's not just conjugation. Right, because it's in the center of the universal enveloping algebra. I think they're both invariant under right and left translation. Is that not correct? I believe so. I think it's more than just conjugation. I think it's really right and left translation. At the level that I'm working, it doesn't really matter so much, but I'm pretty sure that's true. Okay, so this becomes that phi is an eigenfunction for this algebra of differential operators. And finally, the growth condition can be given as, well, I can't do it as being holomorphic at the cusps anymore, like I said. So here it really looks like a condition of moderate growth. Okay? It is a condition of moderate growth. Namely, for any reasonable norm on GL2 plus R, there exists a positive integer such that if you look at the absolute value of the function, that's less than the constant times this norm to the R. R may depend on phi, but that's it's a moderate growth. It's sort of a polynomial growth condition on the group. And the norm is nothing mysterious. Meaning the whole theory of norms on groups that I don't really want to go into, but in some sense, you can just take the norm on GL2 plus, you take it and you think of it inside of 2x2 matrices. 2x2 matrices have a natural norm on them, so you just restrict that. Almost. What you really can take it as is the trace of G transpose G. So that's the sums of the coordinates squared. Okay? That keeps things from being too big, but I'm also not allowed to go to zero. Zero is also considered far away. So I take the trace of G inverse times transpose G inverse, and I take the square root. So that's just basically it's the square root of the sums of the squares of the coordinates of G and the coordinates of G inverse. Okay, keeps it from getting too big to infinity and too small to zero, if you like. So that's sort of what these things translate to. Okay, some regularity in terms of differential equations, some growth condition that, if you remember when we talked about the growth condition on the classical modular form, we said that even though we had written it as sort of look like a polynomial condition, if you wrote it in terms of the variable on the upper half plane, by making the negative terms in the Fourier coefficient all zero, we were really making it not grow exponentially. Okay? So this is not growing exponentially. Okay? Is the way to think of this. Okay. So that's what, that's the first step in doing automorphic forms. You take the classical modular form, you lift it up to GL2 plus R, you make it gamma invariant, and then you just see what you have. Okay? And you have to write things now in terms of this group, in terms of matrices, okay, as opposed to one complex variable. Now, the modern theory, or at least the modern analytic theory, which is really what I'm talking about, you don't really work on GL2R mod a discrete subgroup. You really work adelically. Okay, so, so not on GL2R, but on GL2 of the Adels. Okay, so let me give you a brief introduction to the Adels of Q, or at least the Adels of Q for now. So remember that Q has various completions, right? It's got the real completion, which I think of as Q infinity, and then for each P, it has the p-adic numbers. Okay, and the nice thing about the p-adic numbers is they have a nice compact open subring, the p-adic integers. Okay. In some sense, what the Adels are you just take all these completions and you put them together. Okay? So, in some sense, the Adels are you take R, and then you take the product over all primes, QP, except that's not really a very reasonable space. And so what one does is one puts a prime there, and one takes a restricted product where the restriction is with respect to these compact open groups. Okay? And so sometimes I'll just write this as the product over all places, QV. But now let me tell you what that what that restricted product looks like, because it's really quite a reasonable thing. You take for any finite set S sub F of primes, what you do is you look at R cross, and then for all the primes in this finite set, you take all the p-adics, and then for the remaining set of primes, which is an infinite set, you take Cp. Okay? This is a reasonable space. These are all compact. They're the balls, right? In the p-adic norm, that's absolute value less than or equal to 1. These are the compact balls. And I can take an infinite product of compact spaces. That's compact. That's locally compact. That's locally compact. This is a nice space. This is a locally compact topological space. And then all I do is I take the inductive limit of these things, where here in this context, the inductive limit is just union. And that's what the Adels are. Okay. If you think of them, like I said here, this is going to sit inside the real product of all completions of Q. And if you think of a sort of X as being X infinity, X2, X3, something in the product of all the completions, then X is in the ring. This is called the ring of Adels, if and only if, for almost all P, these components are integrals. They have norm less than 1. So that's really all the Adels are. They want to be the product of all the completions, but that's just too much of a mess. And so you just require things to be integral at almost all places. Now, this does have the nice property that the Adels have a canonical discrete subgroup. Namely, I can just take the rational numbers and embed them into here diagonally. Okay? So I just take Q and it goes into Q, 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 etc. And of course, if I take a rational number for almost all primes, they don't divide either the numerator or denominator, so it's integral. Okay. Yeah, that's true. So there we are. That embeds diagonally. And in fact, if you look at the quotient, that's actually compact. Okay? Now, for what we're doing, we're on GL2 plus R, so for the Adels, that's like just looking at R, and then we have a function that's on GL2 plus R mod GL2 plus Z, okay, so that's looking sort of like R mod Z here, and so we should just note that to recover the integers, the honest integers out of this, you just take the rational numbers and you intersect them with R cross the product over all P, Cp. So you can recover the integers out of this situation. I'll erase while this thing settles down. Okay. Now, So now we do the same thing for GL2. So GL2A, well, on the first hand, this is just 2x2 matrices with the term, with 2x2 matrices with integers in A whose determinant is non-zero. Okay, A is a ring, and that's just 2x2 matrices with determinant in that ring. On the other hand, it is GL2R, and then it's got the restricted product of all the GL2 QPs. Well, this is restricted with respect to, well, so here it was restricted with respect to ZP. Here it's going to be restricted with respect to GL2ZP, which sits inside GL2QP, again, as a maximal compact, and it's also open. Okay, so if you like, this is, it's equal to the limit over finite set of places. I take GL2R, I take GL2QP at a finite number of places, and then I take for an infinite number this compact. So once again, these are compact, locally compact, locally compact. Each piece is locally compact, and then I just take the inverse, the union. So this is, again, a nice locally compact group. I have to figure out where I'm going. So that's a reasonable thing. I have to worry that I don't leave something out here. Okay. It has a canonical discrete subgroup. GL2Q now embeds in GL2A diagonally. Giving a canonical discrete subgroup. And it's not, the quotient is no longer going to be compact, but it has finite covolume modulo the center. So in other words, if you look at the natural volume, I take off the center, GL2Q mod GL2A. This, in some sense, has finite volume. Okay. Okay. All right. So now let me begin to go back and make, oh, I've got another board here, make contact with where I was. So I'm going to write GA. So let me simplify things here. So G is now going to be just GL2. Okay? And so I'm going to write GA as G infinity GF, where G infinity, this is just GL2R. And it contains a maximal subgroup, which is now O2. GF, this is supposed to be the GL2 of the finite part of the Adele, so it's just the product over restricted product of GL2QP. And it contains a maximal compact subgroup, which is just the product of all the GL2ZP. And that's compact and open. Okay, so this thing contains as a maximal compact subgroup K infinity times KF. Well, I guess I didn't say what AF was, did I? AF is just the finite part of the Edels. Just the restricted product of all the chaotic completions. Okay. Now, here's one non-trivial fact that I'm going to have to use. And so this is by, turns out that by strong approximation, for SL2 combined with the fact that the rationals has class number 1, gives, well, what it gives is that, in fact, you can write GL2A as rational matrices, okay? And then modulo rational matrices, everything is either in GL2R, and I can put positive determinant, because I can take my negative determinant in here, times KF. So I allow anything in the real places, I make it integral at the finite places, and then I move that around by this discrete subgroup that sits in diagonally, and I get everything. Okay? On the other hand, if I compute what the intersection is here, well, so I'm looking at, and what does KF do for me? Well, KF is just GL2, where did it go, of all the p-adics. This just makes all my entries be integral. Okay? So this is integral matrices, but they have to have positive determinants. So this is just GL2 plus C. Okay? Which is our old gamma. So, well, if I take GL2A, I mod out by KF on the right, and I mod out by GL2Q on the left, then what I'm left with is GL2 plus R, and then the intersection is gamma. Okay? And this is where my modular form is, or my automorphic form that I lifted up. It's a function here. Okay? So we lift again. Oh, I've also got, I have the center in there. Well, so here we're going to lift. Okay, so I put GL2 plus R modulo gamma, and I had the center. There was my form. Okay, now what this is GL2 of the Edels modulo this compact at the finite evals, my discrete canonical discrete subgroup here, and then it turns out I put all the Edelic center there, and see, now that's good because that's a reasonable space, has finite volume, and this I think of as being a quotient of GL2A mod GL2. And so I lift. And I'm running out of letters. I don't want to use a capital phi, so this is going to be phi once again. Okay. And so now this is some version of my classical modular form that I started with. It just now lives up on GL2A. Okay, so phi is an automorphic form. So, what can we say about this function? Okay, so here's what we can say about phi. Let me stop and point one thing out here before I continue. I did this for SL2Z and I did this for holomorphic modular forms. Okay? If I wanted to do this for gamma naught of n, okay, I essentially do it the same way. How did I get my gamma here? Well, I made all my entries integral by taking this maximal compact subgroup here. Right? If I wanted to get out entries with a congruence condition, that congruence condition would go in this place. And so I wouldn't just, at this point, have KF here. I would have something a little bit smaller to put the congruence condition, but it'd still be compact and open. So I can do this for forms with level. And I could also do this for the MOS forms that Ram talked about last time. There I don't even have to twist to make it gamma invariant. It's already gamma invariant to begin with, and I just lift them up. Okay? So the forms with level or the MOS forms, any of the classical forms I can do this process to, and I get functions here. Now, what can we say about them? Well, first off, phi is a smooth function. And by this I mean the following. So I look at phi of g, and I write g. G has sort of got something in GL2R, and then it's got something in the finite adels. Okay, so g infinity is in GL2R, and gf is in what I call GAF. Okay. Smoothness in the G infinity variable well, this is the usual smoothness. What does smoothness mean in the Archimedean context? It's C infinity. Okay. And smoothness in this non-Archimedean context, for the p-adics, smoothness is locally constant. So the non-Archimedean variables. Okay, so it is a smooth function, so it's nice. But also it satisfies well, the first thing is automorphy. Right? You can see from here it's invariant for everything in my canonical discrete group. Also, it has a k-finiteness property. This is the other part of my automorphy. Remember, I traded gamma modularity and F invariance into gamma invariance and F, some sort of transformation law in F. So here I have F finiteness. What I have for the form I've lifted here is that phi of g k infinity kf is, oops, I want to make this g theta again, is e to the im theta phi of g. And this is for k theta in the compact at infinity, and kf is in this maximal compact here, right? This function is right invariant under the maximal compact, and this property it inherited from its old realization. And more generally, if I look at the space of functions where I write translate by k, this equation says for the functions that I've listed, this is a one-dimensional space. It's basically multiples of the one I started with. I want this to be finite dimensional. Okay. Third condition. Third condition was my regularity, and it hasn't changed because I haven't done anything. That was a condition at the infinite place involving these differential operators. I haven't done anything there, so that condition stays. And now it's ZG finiteness. So I had it that it was an eigenfunction for this algebra of operators, and so I can again say that the space of x phi of g, such that x is a differential operator coming from the center, is finite dimensional. Since I was an eigenfunction, I again had one dimension. Or another way to express this that one commonly finds is there exists an ideal j in this algebra of finite codimension, such that J annihilates phi. Okay, so this says phi is a solution of a system of differential equations.
Mm-hmm. So do you mean that the right translate by K applies? I mean, phi of GK becomes
a function. Oh no, this is as functions. So, yeah, if you like, it's RK of phi, if you want to write it that way. So, yeah, this is a space of functions. So this is, I take rank, translate, I look at that space of functions. Sorry. Okay. So that's my regularity. And finally, I still have my moderate growth. And this says for any norm on, now you just translate it into something on the Adels, there exists a positive integer such that phi of g is less than c norm of g to the r. Again, polynomial growth, and now for a norm, I don't really want to do square roots of sums of squares of integers anymore. So on a Adelic norm, right, on in a finite dimensional real space, it doesn't really matter what norm I take. And if I don't want to take the sums of squares, square root of the sums of squares, I can take something like the box norm, right? And the box norm is what? It's the soup of the coordinates. So that's all we do. So I take the soup over all places of the max over the coordinates. I take the size, that's the size and the viadic norm of the coordinates of G, and the size of the coordinates of the inverse in the viadic norm. So that works. Okay. And the only place it really matters is at infinity, and at infinity I've just replaced the sums of squares by the box norm. So, okay. So there we go. There's all the nice conditions, and really these are just translations of those conditions in the classical modular form through this series of liftings, plus a little bit of relaxing. Okay? So, definition. The space. So these functions, the smooth functions, phi, mapping GL to A to C, satisfying 1 to 4 are called automorphic forms. Well, and let me, they're really the K-finite automorphic forms, but usually these are what, when people speak of automorphic forms, this is what they mean. And I'll denote them by A or A of GL2Q mod GL2A. Okay? And they do contain the lifts of all the regular modular forms, the modular forms with level, the MOS forms. They're all in here. There's one other condition that I didn't, that I is not up here. I didn't put this central, the fact that these were invariant under the center here. And if I want to control the center, so okay. I thought I heard the beginning of a question. So we want to control the center, which is just Z. So this is the center of the group. So this is the same thing. Well, if I look at the adelic points, this is sort of the multiplicative group of edels, of the adels. Then we need a character. And it's still going to be invariant. It's still going to be automorphic. It has to be automorphic because this is invariant under the rational points of the group, and that includes the rational points of the center. So I need a continuous character from the edels module, the principal edels. And then you just let the automorphic forms with central character omega be the set of all automorphic forms such that phi of zg is omega z phi of g. And so, really, the functions that I lifted were in A with the trivial character here. Yes, K star is Q star. But only, this will be the last time. Okay. So now, we forget all of our classical theory, and now we ask about automorphic forms on GLN. Or, in fact, you could do this sort of for G, reductive algebraic group. It's all going to look the same from this point in some sense, for what I do for the rest of today and next time. Okay? Well, I'm going to want them on some, basically I could just write down the same definition. If you look at all of these conditions, there's nothing up here where 2 plays a role. Right? So you just, basically what I'm going to do is I'm going to write this down again. Except I do want to work not just over Q. You can really work over any global field, but for what we're going to do, we might as well work over a number field. Okay? So let's take K to be a number field. So finite extension of Q. It's ring of integers. Okay? It should be clear what its ring of adels are. So the adels of K should be this restricted tensor product over all completions, which is, again, the limit over S of product V and S sum completions, and then the product V not in S. Well, let's see. What have I done here? I've gotten a little bit ahead of myself. I'll put OV here. So here, I don't want that to go up. So so let's see. OV is contained in KV as a maximal compact for the non-Archimedean places. So these are the ones that divide the finite prime. So I'll write V less than infinity. And S is any finite set of primes of, no, just of places now. And I always want it, I'm going to now just make it contain the Archimedean places. So I didn't quite, notation's a little bit different. And I can always write this as sort of like what I did before, K infinity times KF, where K infinity is just the product over all the Archimedean completions, which, if this thing has R1 real completions and R2 complex completions, this is just R to the R1, C to the R2. And the finite part of the Adels is just, this is where the restricted product really takes place, is at the finite places. Okay. Right. And again, K embeds diagonally, and K mod A is compact, just like before. I'm shaking here. So GLN looks exactly the same. It's the limit. Inductive limits are just union of product V and S. I take the full matrices over the completions for almost all of them. And then for the others, I take integral matrices. And these, again, are maximal. These are compact and open inside the p-adic completions. So I'm going to let G be GLN. G infinity is then GLN of K infinity. It's just GLN R, R1 copies, GLN C, R2 copies, and it has a maximal compact, which now looks like ON, R1 copies, UN, R2 copies. I've got GF, which is G of the finite Adels, so the product of GLN, KV, and this always contains the maximal compact, which is just the product of all the integer, p-adic integral matrices. Okay. Well, I've already erased, so. And then, let's see, GLN K embeds in GLN A as a canonical discrete. And the volume, if I take off the center and the discrete mod the adelic. It's finite. I need my invariant differential operators, so so we let G is the complexified the algebra of, well, now I have to do all of K infinity. I have to have differential operators all of these places. Okay. Sorry, not K infinity, but G infinity. Okay, so I get a certain number of copies of, well, they're basically all just matrices, full matrices rings. Again, there's a universal enveloping algebra. And a center. And now, I make exactly the same definition. I have everything that I needed to define automorphic forms. So, a smooth function, now on GLNA to C. And again, anything in GLNA can be written as something in here times something in here. C infinity here, locally constant here, just like it was before. That's what smooth means. Is an automorphic form if, well, I'll just, oh, I'm almost on time. I'll just write down what I need. Automorphy, this is for all gamma now in GLNK, my discrete group. K finiteness, I still like writing it this way. Finite dimensional. This is a condition both at for K. Did I write down what K was? Probably not. K is always, I have the Archimedean part and the non-Archimedean part. ZG finite, so when I differentiate by any of the operators coming from the center, this is finite dimensional. And now this really is, this is the Lie algebra. These are the differential operators acting just at the Archimedean places. This is this condition is just on GLNR and GLNC. And finally, moderate growth. And the definition of norm I gave before works equally well on GLN, not just GL2. So that's what automorphic forms are on GLN, and you could do the same thing for any reductive group if you wanted to. And so again, A is a space of automorphic forms, and sometimes